Tom Bayless, on behalf of Savage Sports Holdings, Inc., the FLE, it's my pleasure to introduce Mr. John Ertman and Mr. Christopher Heideck of Robeson Gray in New York City. Mr. Ertman will be making the argument.
Welcome to the court.
Good morning, Justices. Justice Holland, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely, Tom Buchanan, on behalf of RAA.
Welcome.
He'll be making the argument this morning. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll tell you about the clock as you approach the podium. When I start the clock, you'll have your full 20 minutes. When the light changes from green to yellow, that's the time you've reserved. You can continue, but you know, you'll be using your reserve time.
Thank you. Yeah. May it please the court, Thomas Buchanan of Winston Strawn on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, RAA Management. The issue before the court is whether a seller of a company can immunize itself against fraudulent misrepresentations during the due diligence process by having the potential buyer sign a non-disclosure agreement with a provision that warrants that the seller is not covering or warranting the completeness and accuracy of the materials to be disclosed in the due diligence process. In other words, do the terms accuracy and completeness cover fraud? And we would submit that either a layman's view of that term, a dictionary term, a legal term, it does not, or they do not. For example, if one were to file a complaint against a defendant for fraud in the Delaware courts or any courts and allege simply that the defendant had failed to be complete in its disclosures or accurate in its representations, that would not constitute fraud without the words knowing and willful, specific intent. Same with a jury instruction in a criminal or civil case. The court would never instruct a jury that someone could be found guilty of fraud in a civil or criminal case by merely failing to omit certain information, not being complete in its representations or accurate.
But there's no state of mind requirement listed in the provision, correct?
There's no, it simply says we do not warrant the completeness and accuracy of the evaluation materials to be disclosed in due diligence.
The way you phrased the issue, it sounds almost global. That is, that no, what I would call anti-reliance clause, no matter how worded, could, to use your words, immunize the seller from a fraud claim. Is that your argument, or is your argument more narrow based on the language of this particular anti-reliance clause?
I think it's both. I would submit that.
Well, how can it be both? Is it's either one or the other, or in the alternative?
Well, I would say that it's the narrow interpretation, in the sense that the law requires, if you're going to disclaim anything, particularly fraud, you need to be specific. Well, so in this case, clearly they did not specifically disclaim that. Look, if you go in and look and do due diligence, do not.
So you're saying that there is some conceivable wording, which you were, I guess, about to elaborate before I interrupted, under which an anti-reliance clause could immunize the selling company. Is that right?
Possibly, but. Yes, if you put in such a provision, again, at the inception of due diligence, not after due diligence, after negotiations, after a final purchase agreement by sophisticated parties, at the inception, if you were to say anything we say to you during due diligence, anything we represent to you, you shouldn't rely on any of it because we're not going to vouch for anything we say whatsoever, and in fact, we could lie to you and you're going to have to live with it.
Okay, so the real issue then is whether the language of this particular anti-reliance clause is specific enough, or to put it differently, what degree of specificity would be required to enable the seller to be legally immunized?
Correct, to put us on notice that we were aware that we were going into this due diligence knowing that anything they presented to us could be false. They could cook the books. They could commit criminal conduct by sending us stuff through the mails and the wires that was fraudulent. They could be prosecuted criminally, but we'd have no civil remedy unless we went through the process, closed, and then sued based on the final purchase agreement.
Okay. Tell us again, or me again, precisely what type of specific language would be required and what the source of your claim is, that is, what case supports it?
Well, I think if you went to the, I'll go back to say that it would have to contain a language that put someone on notice that they could be defrauded. And I think it, once you do that, you're never going to have an agreement. There's no question that if the buyers, the potential buyers, were in a room with the seller, Savage, and they had said, by the way, or if the question arose that you just asked, Your Honor, and the buyer said, well, what do these words mean, completeness and accuracy? What are you referring to there? We're saying that anything we say to you, you shouldn't trust because, you know, we may not give you everything. We may intentionally withhold information. We may lie to you. And what would happen? They would all walk out. There's no business purpose or legal purpose to support or enforce such a provision the way that the appellee says it is. It's different if you go through the due diligence process and you have sophisticated parties, and there's representations like in the various cases that have been cited, the Progressive case, IVP, and the Great Lakes case, where you have sophisticated parties in the same business, the same industry, the food business.
Okay, well, the answer to, I guess, the first part of the question is that the language of the anti-reliance clause has to say, in words if not substance, that that you are foregoing any claim, including one based on fraud arising out of the conduct of due diligence.
That's correct.
Okay, the second question is there any case that supports that requirement?
So this is a case in first impression in the sense that there's no other case that deal with fraudulent misrepresentations in the due diligence process without a final purchase agreement and without the seller, potential seller, relying on provisions in a final purchase agreement as opposed to solely in a non-disclosure agreement. However, the Avery course case, excuse me, speaks to the issue at length about the a provision in a contract that says the seller is disclaiming breaches of a certain type, defaults, inaccuracies, and also misrepresentations. And the court said, if you take the word misrepresentations, if that is in a confidentiality agreement or a non-disclosure agreement, a final purchase, that could possibly cover fraud, at least negligent misrepresentations. But the court went on length to discuss all the cases that have been cited here that preceded it, and it basically said the bottom line, at least with regard to a final purchase agreement, fraud within that contract, we're not going to allow fraud to be enforced. We're not going to allow the perpetrator of a fraud to enforce an agreement that was formed through fraud. That's what the court held in that case. The cases relied upon by the appellee, the IVF case, which involved a deal with Tyson's Food, two huge food companies, and the
IVP, you mean?
IVP, I'm sorry. And the Great Lakes.
The cases that address the issue of anti-reliance clauses involve fully integrated, executed agreements. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct.
And here we're basically not even close to that point.
That's exactly right.
We're engaged in due diligence, and all we have is a preliminary agreement covering the conduct of due diligence. And that's the big dividing line that you're asking us to draw.
Yes, as well as the language. And it's, so you're saying preemptively they've covered themselves against their own fraud, which if you go to the business purpose, why the case in IVP, the Great Lakes case, and the others, they said, look, we have two sophisticated parties that are going through due diligence, excessive, extensive due diligence, they use those words, and negotiations. They enter into an agreement, and they have an integrated merger incorporation clause in there. And that clause covers the precise misrepresentations alleged to be the fraud. So what the court is saying is we're not going to buy this fraud. We're not going to buy it. There's total disbelief in those cases that there was even fraud. In the IDP case and in the Great Lakes Pharmacia case, the court went through the representations or alleged misrepresentations, found that they were nothing more than forecasts and projections, which in almost every case were either corrected before closing, updated, or weren't false at all.
That's what they found in both those cases. They really didn't ultimately rely on the anti-reliance provisions in those cases. However, in the IBP case, what the provision there, there were three different disclaimers. One of them was about 200 words long that specifically covered any projections, any financials, anything that was given. So those cases are saying, as you pointed out, the dividing line, look, you knew about the fraud. You knew about the projections. You knew about the financial statements that you're now saying apart. Then you went and closed. And the agreement says you can't rely on those. Here's everything you can rely on. Here are the reps and warranties. Here's the index that contains all the assets and liabilities. This is it. And they buy it. And then what happens? The company goes down, buyer's remorse.
One more two-part question. As you candidly acknowledge, there are no Delaware cases on this issue, so it is one of first impression, at least for us. Are there cases from any other jurisdiction that support your contention in the specific context of a due diligence governing contract?
I didn't find any, Your Honor.
It's first impression nationally.
Yes, I would say so. And okay. The Avery case does give a laundry list of cases. Okay. From various states.
Second part of the question. Since your position rests on the distinction between a fully integrated executed contract and circumstances where there's no contract other than a preliminary agreement governing the investigation or due diligence, why wouldn't the case for upholding an anti-reliance clause be even stronger in this type of situation than it would be in the situation where the contract, the merger contract, has already been executed?
Before I answer that question, I would add that the restatement on contracts, as opposed to a case law authority, does speak at length about fraud with regard to contracts. I think it's pretty clear, Corbin and every other treatise, they say that fraud vitiates everything, which the Avery case talks about. And you so even if you have a final integrated contract, you shouldn't enforce it.
I thought you'd already said there are some conceivable circumstances where an anti-reliance clause could bar a claim even for fraud. So I assume that by citing the restatement, you're not reversing your position on that.
No, what I'm saying is, in response to your question, is there any other case law? And I wanted to complete my answer that there is the restatements that don't specifically talk about a non-disclosure agreement at the inception of due diligence, but they speak in general terms with various examples that fraud vitiates everything. Now, you asked whether it's stronger, the plaintiff's argument is stronger, or I'm sorry, the
right, yeah.
Savage's argument.
I mean, since we're in first impression land, then if we're to rule your way, then it would have to be on the basis of some overriding public policy
that's
consideration.
Correct.
And just to restate my question, if there is a public policy issue here, why doesn't it weigh even more heavily in favor of upholding an anti-reliance clause in this very preliminary context than it would even in the context of a final, fully integrated, executed agreement?
Well, in the Avery case talks at length about the notion of fraud vitiating every contract, everything it touches, and it refused to enforce the provision in that case because of public policy, and it discussed at length. Now, at a minimum, in the cases that have closed, you have notice and knowledge. You have notice that you can't rely on anything that's happened before, and you have knowledge of all the representations. Here, we're at the inception of due diligence. We have no knowledge of what's going to be disclosed or what's going to be said. We're not relying on anything at this point except two words that will be complete and accurate, which in the normal course would mean they're going to do their best. Good faith, fair dealing is embedded in every contract. So the public policy would be that people should not defraud other people and that they should put them on notice if they can't trust them, in which case you're never going to have a contract, whether it's a nondisclosure agreement or a final purchase agreement in any event.
Is this a case where sophisticated parties have actually agreed upon a remedy? In other words, if you get inaccurate information, your remedy is to put in a warranty into the final merger agreement.
No, I don't believe that's this case. I think you have two provisions in the contract, and the court below relied on the provision in paragraph 7. It did not, in my view, rely on paragraph 8, which I think the court may be referring to, which talks about you cannot assert that there is a transaction or a contract unless there's a final definitive agreement. So any of the terms that we discuss here or throughout the due diligence process, you can't come back and say we formed a contract. I believe that's what that provision refers to, and it's clearly that's not what happened here.
Counsel, I'm a little confused by your response to the earlier question. If we're talking about an actionable fraud, that is a concealment of some material fact in the course of due diligence, it would have to be the type of concealment that would prevent the fact from being uncovered during the due diligence process. Would you agree?
No, I would not agree with that, Your Honor, because the disclosure, non-disclosure doesn't make it material. It could mean that you waited.
No, I didn't say the non-disclosure made it material. Let's assume that it is material, but non-disclosed during the due diligence process. It would have to be that, it would have to be a material fact that's incapable of being uncovered during the due diligence process in order for your theory to work, would it not?
Well, I don't think so. But in this particular case, what we have is various discussions where we asked, are there any contingent liabilities? Keep in mind, RAA is a startup investment company looking to invest money, and the investor, his business was in the financial industry and credit cards, and so they know nothing about this particular industry, the arms industry, so they're looking to get all the information they can. Okay, so this is a new venture, and this is not an industry he's at all familiar with. So they asked? They said contingent liabilities. There are none other than listed. Here are six cases, small cases we have. It turns out there was a patent lawsuit of $40 million. They never told us about it. They knew it back in April 10th, last year of 2010, and they didn't tell us about it. We learned about it after it was filed. The environmental liabilities, they said there were none. There were no administrative actions by states, governments, federal governments. There's no Superfund. They even provided a form that answered the questions. No Superfund litigation, no administrative litigation related to environmental crimes, no claims on environment. Turns out they had a huge Superfund claim against them that they had known back for a year. And then we asked about unionization because we had
plenty. Well, I asked you a question at a much more, a higher level of generality, and you're talking about the facts of a specific case. Again, the question is, in order for your theory to work, aren't we talking about a concealment of a material fact that by its nature would not be discoverable or uncoverable during the due diligence process?
I would disagree because I think...
Okay, why not?
Because I think if we were alleged fraudulent misrepresentations, we asked specific questions about specific issues and they responded, they do not exist. And provided things in writing, they do not exist. That is a specific fraudulent misrepresentation in response to a specific question. There was reliance that we continued to go forward. We spent the money, and we only went forward. Had they told us at day one that there's going to be unionization at this plant, we could be, that we have environmental liabilities, we have this patent case, we could have gone forward or not. And if we had gone forward, we'd have to live with it. But we would have the choice. We would be on notice. We'd be informed. We'd have the knowledge that those cases that involve a final definitive agreement have. But they knew about the representation about the financials. They said, we're not relying on those. They closed, buyer's remorse. They sued. If I may, I would like to reserve 1 minute.
Very well.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Justice Jacobs, you asked if there were policy reasons to enforce the disclaimers in the party's NDA, and absolutely there are numerous legitimate overriding reasons why the disclaimers in the party's NDA should be enforced and the dismissal of this case should be affirmed. RAA's principal argument, in their papers at least, is that there is no purpose to the disclaimers in the party's NDA here other than to promote fraud. Nothing could be further from the truth. Okay. Among the many legitimate reasons about why the disclaimer should be enforced is, number one, to enforce the NDA here is to promote the efficient functioning of the M&A markets. RAA and Savage, both very sophisticated parties, at the outset got together and agreed in the NDA to a due diligence process that's very commonplace in the world of M&A. Savage agreed to give RAA access to its confidential information, allow RAA to come in and do a due diligence investigation and bid on the company.
Chairman, yes. Just to make sure I get the drift of where you're going.
Yes.
Mr. Buchanan conceded that the crux of the other side's position is that the anti-reliance language here was not specific enough.
Yes.
And that's really what we're focusing on. I gather your response is, yes, it is specific enough.
Yes, and there's long precedent to the effect of, yes, this disclaimer language is more than specific enough and more than put RAA on notice about the process it was agreeing into and what it was waiving. In fact, this exact disclaimer language at issue here was addressed by the Court of Chancery in the In Re IBP case in 2001. In that case, the seller, IBP, and the buyer, Tyson, entered at the outset of their negotiations into a confidentiality agreement which had verbatim identical disclaimer as in this case. Tyson agreed, the bidder agreed, that the seller was not making any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the seller's due diligence information, which is exactly what we have here. The Court of Chancery held that under Delaware law or New York law, this disclaimer language barred a due diligence fraud claim. The Court of Chancery held, and this is footnotes 179 and 180 in In Re IBP, and I point that out because the discussion is scattered throughout a long opinion. It's not easy to find this discussion. So we mentioned it in our brief, but I'll mention it here. That the Chancery Court said, and again, this disclaimer is verbatim identical to here. The disclaimer did not say, we're disclaiming all reps or warranties except fraud claims are preserved. The Court of Chancery said that the intent of the disclaimer language is clear, that language was intended to require the bidder to waive all due diligence deficiencies as a basis for a lawsuit, other than representations or warranties in a final sale agreement. The Court of Chancery went on to hold that to not enforce the NDA under Delaware or New York law would deprive the seller of its legitimate contractual expectations. Okay. So too in this case.
Well, those expectations have to be consistent with New York law, don't they? And what about the peculiar knowledge exception? How can that be addressed at the motion to dismiss?
Yes, we submit, Your Honor, that the peculiar knowledge exception has absolutely no relevance or application to the facts of this case, okay, for several reasons. Okay, first of all, the peculiar knowledge cases are a scattering of New York cases, and by the way, it's not recognized in Delaware, and our position here is that you could equally just as much apply Delaware law as New York law, but if assuming that you were to apply New York law, it's only in a scattering of cases on a very different fact pattern with a very different disclaimer than what we have here. In the peculiar knowledge cases, these are closed transaction cases where the buyer represents in the final sale contract that it had the opportunity to do a complete investigation on its own, and it was relying only on its own investigation. And then long after the closing, something horrible is discovered about the property, which the seller had actively and deeply concealed. And the issue in those cases is did the was the buyer afforded enough of an opportunity to investigate so that they could have uncovered the bad things through reasonable due diligence or not? That's a fact issue that's unique to those cases. It has nothing to do with this case, where we have a due diligence process where this isn't a case where after closing concealed information that couldn't have been found through reasonably been found through diligence, due diligence came out. If you look at what they're complaining about, the New York environmental litigation, they allege in the complaint they found that out themselves in the course of due diligence. So that's hardly something that was peculiarly within Savage's knowledge. Likewise, the unionization efforts and the patent-related lawsuit, these were things that were disclosed by Savage to RAA in the due diligence process. Okay. It would make no sense to apply the peculiar knowledge exception.
Was the exception alleged in the complaint?
I'm not aware of that being alleged in the complaint, no. I think that first appears in the briefing on the motion to dismiss in the Superior Court. Okay. To apply it under this fact pattern makes no sense because you could never enforce an NDA. A seller could never enforce an NDA against and prevent a disruptive lawsuit like this one because a disgruntled walk-away bidder like RAA here can always claim, would always be able to claim, we didn't learn something early enough in due diligence. Something came to us 3 weeks later than we wanted it to, and by definition, that was within the seller's knowledge at the outset. Okay, so we couldn't have found it out until 3 weeks in. All right. Okay. In addition, the Second Circuit and various federal district courts in New York have held that you do not apply the peculiar knowledge exception in circumstances where the buyer could have easily and inexpensively negotiated out of the risk in question. So, for example, in this case, RAA could have negotiated with Savage for a representation in the NDA that all of the due diligence information that was going to be provided was going to be accurate and complete. They also could have negotiated a cutback of the disclaimers, make them more limited than they are. But they chose not to do that. Okay. If they had attempted to do that and Savage said no, they could have walked away from the deal. Okay. But as Judge Silverman recognized in dismissing this case, they voluntarily entered into this arrangement. They are a highly sophisticated party. Admittedly, in the complaint itself, they indicate that. They were represented by highly sophisticated deal counsel. They knew exactly what they were doing. Okay. And as Judge Silverman pointed out in dismissing the case, okay, the only reason that RAA was doing an extensive due diligence investigation was because they knew at the outset that they could not rely on the accuracy or completeness of the information that Savage was providing. That's the whole point of due diligence.
Well, right? it sounds as if you're almost turning the other side's argument on its head. That is to say, the other side is arguing that for your client to be, in their words, immunized from any risk of liability, the anti-reliance clause would have to be very specific on that point. Your argument is that if the buyer here is going to be entitled to recover a portion of its due diligence cost after it walked away from the negotiation, then by parity of reasoning, the anti-reliance clause or whatever the disclaimer clause would have to be would have to make it clear to your side that they were assuming the risk that the other side might rely on what it was given during due diligence, and if that information wasn't complete, that they would have a cause of action.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, Your Honor, because, yes, it is the reasonable expectation, given the language here of Savage, that the NDA is going to be respected under basic principles of contractual construction. The disclaimer is broad. It covers all due diligence information, regardless of what the state of mind is in Savage in providing that information. Okay, and not only is there the disclaimer in Section 7 about the accuracy or completeness of due diligence information, but there's also the waiver in Section 8, which REA does not address at all, but is real and exists, in which they agreed that if there is no deal, negotiations break down, they walk away. They will not bring litigation, and that includes litigation over a due diligence deficiency. Right. So we
my
have
understanding is the way you think the rule should work is during due diligence, the would-be seller says to the buyer, you're on your own. Find out whatever you can find out. And to the extent you discover things that are fraud, misrepresentation, anything, you can walk away. And if you decide you still want to go forward, notwithstanding what you found out, then when you're executing the final agreement is when you negotiate for the representation that we did our due diligence, we're satisfied, we found whatever we found, we still want to go forward. But to the extent we didn't find something, and you said something to the contrary, we're entitled to rely on your representation. But that, and the process is really bifurcated between you're on your own to find things, and if you still want to go forward, then you protect yourself in the final agreement against fraud or misrepresentation.
That is exactly right. That is the process the parties agreed to in the NDA.
Just
yes.
To make sure I understand.
Yes.
I guess footnoting Justice Hung's point, the protection that you would have once the due diligence is completed and the negotiations are completed are to nail down whatever uncertainties there are in reps and warranties in the agreement itself.
Absolutely. That is the protection. Right. But in the meantime, as a condition to come in and have access to the confidential information, and in the meantime, the bidder is agreeing that and as the Court of Chancery held in IBP, that they are waiving any claims arising out of a breakdown in negotiations, and they are waiving due diligence deficiencies as a basis for a lawsuit. And that's important because if the NDA disclaimers here are not enforced, right, that provides RAA with a leverage to assert this quote-unquote fraud claim, which they filed at the time that the target company is for sale and very sensitive to lawsuits. And they expressly agreed as a sophisticated party in the NDA, that's exactly what they wouldn't want to do. And with the seller facing the prospect of a long, drawn-out, time-consuming litigation if the NDA isn't enforced, that gives the bidder leverage to extract a settlement payment or some other concession which it otherwise wouldn't be entitled to under the NDA. Okay. And if the NDA here were deemed unenforceable, okay, what that would mean in the world of mergers and acquisitions is that no seller could ever protect itself and prevent precisely this type of disruptive lawsuit, which REA has chose to bring here in breach of the NDA. Okay.
So is it your position then that this provision, anti-reliance clause, does permit an outright intentional lie, and you just assume the risk of that?
What it does is it causes the bidder to waive making that claim. Okay, that's how it operates. They've agreed they won't bring that claim. Okay, an element of fraud is reliance. Okay, but they are agreeing at the outset that this information, this due diligence information, they are not going to rely on. That's what they, as a sophisticated party, that's what they're agreeing to. Okay, unless and except a final transaction is reached, and then the universe of representations and warranties that are going to be actionable by the seller are those that are set forth in that final written agreement.
It sounds like you're trying to sugarcoat your answer to Justice Ridgely's question. I thought the answer would be, yes, the agreement does allow for the possibility of outright fraud.
Yes.
But it also prescribes a remedy, and the remedy is that the defrauded party can walk away.
Yes, to the extent things are discovered they don't like, they can negotiate around that and reach a deal and negotiate.
Or if they decide not to walk away, then they can protect themselves by negotiating reps and warranties in the final merger agreement.
Yes.
And that's really what the Superior Court held. That's the issue before us, because if we talk about the three issues in this particular case. The one about, one of them was kind of quantified by negotiating. The other two were on the horizon, so to speak, depending on whose view you take, but the actual complaints were filed in February. And what the Superior Court said is, for purposes of this, my ruling, the Superior Court's ruling, I'll assume it was fraud, and fraud's covered.
Yes. The basis of the decision below was the assumption that all of the allegations in the complaint are correct and fraud was committed here. Yes. But even assuming so, that the NDA disclaimers should be enforced.
And so it goes back to my earlier question, that your argument is premised on a two-stage process during which, during the due diligence period, this language is broad enough to cover fraud. Your remedy, as Justice Jacobs asked in his question, is to walk away, but to the extent you go forward and you need the protection against fraud, you negotiate that in the final agreement.
Yes, that is accurate. That is our position in the case. That's how that was the process that was negotiated here between the two sophisticated parties. And there's no question, they're claiming some type of ambiguity. There's no ambiguity. And you know, if you look at the discussion in the IBP case, that on the same language as the Court of Chancery said there, it's absolutely, it was clear to RAA going into this that this is the process that they agreed to.
Does the record reflect whether this provision is a standard provision in M&A, this particular paragraph?
Well, on the motion to dismiss, we have no data about that, but we could see the extensive case law where this type of disclaimer is enforced, and it does appear in the confidentiality agreement in the IBP case, so that's precedent. So corporate drafters of these agreements see the IPP precedent and see that language in IPP, this exact language, was approved as barring a due diligence fraud claim. And so that is the precedent. So I can't testify here.
It's a standard form of agreement, but it's not the standard form.
I wouldn't know, but I would know my firm specializes in M&A. Yet this is the form we use. Okay, and it is supported by the Delaware precedent. It has been analyzed, approved, and deemed to be effective by the Court of Chancery. I think I've covered all the issues.
Very well.
Okay, thank you very much.
I would just point out that the court in Avery addressed this issue. It was written by Judge Ivey, the same judge that wrote IBP. And there he said you should not be enforcing contracts that are based on fraud, and that was after negotiations and a due diligence. And and in IBP, the court found there was no fraud. Again, it was just puffery. In terms of the terms of accuracy and completeness, I do not see how any court could find that those terms cover fraud, that they immunize someone to commit fraud. To find that in no way, this court found that they didn't cover fraud, would it disrupt M&A, because people don't lie and make misrepresentations during due diligence as a practice. Obviously, if they're uncovered, they're finished as a business. No one's going to close. We were going to acquire this company and its management. Why would we ever do that if they're lying to us?
Well, do you agree that the peculiar knowledge exception under New York law was not pled in the complaint?
We did not plead that, but I didn't think we have to plead it because it's a legal concept. I don't think it has to be pled, and I think it applies under the Tahini case and under Cronenberg. It would apply, and the information here was clearly in their peculiar knowledge. The only reason we found out is because it was made public. They didn't disclose this to us. This lawsuit was filed. The NLRB published a notice that there was unionization efforts, and we found out through the New York State about the environmental thing. So it became public. They didn't disclose it to us.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for your arguments. The court will take the matter under advisement and will take a brief recess.